Okay, just take a moment. Think about where you are. What if everything around you, the sounds, the feeling of the air, even, I don't know, your own thoughts.
Yeah.
What if it's all just part of some incredibly detailed construct? Is what you're feeling right now actually real? Or could it be something else? Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're diving headfirst into, well, one of the most mind-bending, maybe even unsettling ideas around the simulation hypothesis. Basically, it's the notion that what we think of as reality might just be a super advanced computer simulation, and us, maybe we're just, you know, programs running inside it.
Right. It sounds like pure science fiction, doesn't it?
Yeah.
But the idea has surprisingly deep philosophical roots, mm-hmm. and it got a more formal treatment in modern philosophy thanks to Nick Bostrom back in 2003. So yeah, we're definitely in for a bit of a mind-bending ride today.
We absolutely are. So our mission for this deep dive, let's unpack where this, frankly, audacious idea even came from, trace its ancient roots. Then we'll dig into Bostrom's really influential argument, the one that kind of brought it into the 21st century. We'll weigh the big criticisms, and there are quite a few.
Oh, yeah.
Explore if anyone's actually trying to test this, you know, scientifically.
Right. Can we even check?
And finally, look at how this whole concept has just exploded in popular culture. So yeah, get ready. We're about to question, well, pretty much everything. Okay, so to really get this modern idea, we need to go back.
Way.
Way back. Because the simulation hypothesis, it might feel really current, techy, you know, but questioning reality itself, that's not new at all. Humans have been wrestling with this doubt for like millennia.
Absolutely. It echoes across history in really different cultures, too.
Yeah.
You look at ancient China, there's the philosopher Zhuangzi.
Ah, the butterfly dream.
Exactly. He dreamt he was a butterfly, then woke up and genuinely wasn't sure. Was he a man who dreamt he was a butterfly, or is he now a butterfly dreaming he's a man?
It perfectly captures that uncertainty, doesn't it?
It really does. And then you have Indian philosophy, the concept of Maya.
The world as illusion.
Pretty much, yeah. A veil over what's truly real. Even ancient Greek thinkers like Anaxarchus and Monimus, they talked about reality being like impressions experienced in sleep or madness.
Wow, okay.
And if you look at Aztec philosophy, some texts theorize the world as a kind of painting or book created by the Peel, like a divine construct. Even Gnosticism had this idea of reality being made by a lesser god, maybe even a malevolent one. A flawed simulation, you could almost say.
And in Western philosophy, you just can't skip Plato's allegory of the cave, right?
Oh, no, definitely not. It's fundamental. The prisoner's chained up, only seeing shadows, mistaking those flickering shapes for the whole truth. It's such a powerful metaphor for, you know, our potentially limited perception.
So how did that line of thinking evolve?
Well, René Descartes really formalized it philosophically. He came up with the evil demon thought experiment.
Right. What if some super powerful, cunning being is just feeding us lies, deceiving all our senses.
Exactly. And that thought experiment, it directly leads to things like the brain in a vat scenario.
Yeah. Oh, yes. The disembodied brain hooked up thinking it's living a normal life.
Mm-hmm. And the core question is always the same. How could you possibly know if you were in that situation? How could you tell the difference?
Okay, so we have these deep philosophical roots, these ancient doubts. How does it leap into, like, computers and physics?
That's where it gets really interesting in the modern era. Back in 1969, Konrad Zuse, a German computer pioneer, he actually wrote a book called Calculating Space.
Okay.
And in it, he proposed this idea of a fundamentally computational universe, basically digital physics. The universe itself is a giant computation.
Whoa.
And then later, the roboticist Hans Moravec, he speculated that maybe our reality is a simulation run by future intelligences.
So the seeds were planted for what came next.
Precisely. It set the stage perfectly for Nick Bostrom.
Right. So Nick Bostrom, 2003, he publishes his simulation argument. Now, it's really important to get this right. Despite the name, he's not flat out saying we are in a simulation.
No, that's a common misconception.
It's more subtle. He presents this compelling trilemma, like a situation where one of three possibilities is almost certainly true. It's more of a logical puzzle about existence.
That's a great way to put it. So Bostrom's three propositions are, basically, one, the chance of civilizations like ours reaching a post-human stage where they could run super realistic ancestor simulations is practically zero. Maybe we would blow ourselves up. Maybe there are limits.
Okay, possibility one, we don't make it that far.
Possibility two, civilizations do reach that stage, but the number actually interested in running these simulations is practically zero. Maybe it's unethical. Maybe it's boring to them. Who knows?
Right. They could, but they just don't.
And possibility three, The fraction of all conscious beings with experiences like ours who are actually living in a simulation is very close to one.
Meaning we are almost definitely simulated.
Exactly. If option three is true, then simulated beings vastly outnumber real beings.
And that's where the anthropic reasoning comes in, the kind of aha moment.
Precisely. If proposition three is true, and almost everyone like us is in a simulation, then statistically speaking, the odds are overwhelmingly high that we are among them.
So it's a numbers game. If there are billions of simulated worlds and only one base reality,
you're much more likely to find yourself in one of the simulations.
Okay. But this whole argument hinges on some pretty big assumptions, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Crucial ones. First, you have to assume that consciousness isn't exclusively biological, that it can emerge from computational processes.
That a sufficiently complex program could actually be conscious.
Right. Second, that these simulations would be incredibly high fidelity, so good they'd be genuinely indistinguishable from reality.
No glitches, no obvious sign.
Mm-hmm. And third, that running simulations within simulations would be feasible, computationally speaking, that you wouldn't need, you know, infinite resources in the real world.
Which leads to the big question, how would we ever find out? Did Bostrom offer any ideas?
Well, he did joke about maybe a window popping up saying, you know, you are living in a simulation, click here.
Huh. Yeah, right.
But he also seriously considered that any imperfections, any glitches, might just be deliberately purged or patched by the simulators to maintain the illusion.
So finding proof might be impossible by design.
It could be. But Bostrom sees his argument differently from, say, old-school philosophical skepticism. He calls it a metaphysical hypothesis, but one with interesting empirical reasons behind it.
Meaning there might actually be ways to investigate it, unlike just saying maybe everything is a dream.
Kind of. He notes that most people who engage with the argument accept the logic of the trilemma. They just disagree on which of the three propositions is the most likely one. Some bet on extinction, some bet on disinterest.
And some bet we're in the matrix right now.
Essentially, yes. As he puts it, unless we are now living in a simulation, our descendants will almost certainly never run an ancestor simulation. It connects our fate to the likelihood of the hypothesis.
Okay, so Bostrom lays out this compelling, if unsettling, argument, but it definitely hasn't gone unchallenged, right? What's the pushback?
Oh, there's been significant pushback. Lots of criticisms. We can maybe group them a bit.
Yeah, let's try.
Okay, first, there are challenges around consciousness. This is a big one.
Right, can a simulation actually feel like anything?
Exactly. The consciousness problem. Some philosophers argue that simulated beings, sims, might not have genuine conscious experiences like us unsimulated folk presumably do. They might just be incredibly complex puppets, you know.
Like philosophical zombies.
Sort of, yeah. And to address this, philosopher Barry Dayton proposed a variation, neural ancestor simulations.
Neural? How does that work?
Instead of simulating consciousness in a computer, what if future beings just grew actual biological brains in vats? Or maybe induce ultra-realistic shared hallucinations directly into real minds?
Whoa. Okay, so that sidesteps the whole can computers be conscious debate.
Right. It uses consciousness we already accept exists, but keeps the core simulation question. Are we experiencing one of those induced reality?
Clever. Okay, what other kinds of objections are there?
Then you have the feasibility challenges. Often from physicists. People like Sabine Hassenfelder argue it's basically physically impossible to simulate our entire universe down to the quantum level without creating inconsistencies we could detect.
So the simulation would have tells, glitches.
Yeah, potentially.
Yeah.
She's even called the whole idea of pseudoscience and religion. And cosmologist George F.R. Ellis is pretty blunt, too, calls it totally impracticable, something for a late-night pub discussion.
Ouch.
Their point is often about the sheer scale, the computational power needed. It seems astronomical, maybe even fundamentally impossible, according to our current understanding of physics.
And isn't there skepticism about the whole reasoning method itself?
Yes, the rejection of anthropic reasoning.
Mm-hmm.
Some scholars just dismiss it as merely philosophical, or worse, unfalsifiable. Mm-hmm. If you can't test it, is it really science?
Right. The Karl Popper criterion.
Mm-hmm.
What about time? You mentioned something earlier about future simulators maybe not existing yet.
Yeah, that falls under philosophical roadblocks and logical contradictions. It's the presentism objection. If the simulators are future humans, but we exist now, how can they be running our present simulation if their now hasn't happened yet? It messes with the statistical argument.
Okay, that's a bit of a head scratcher.
It is. And Sean Carroll, the cosmologist, points out another potential contradiction. If we assume humans are typical beings in the universe, and we clearly can't run these simulations yet, then why assume other hypothetical civilizations can do it so easily?
Yeah.
It makes us seem uniquely incapable, which contradicts the assumption of typicality used in the Anthropic reasoning.
Right. Why would we be the exception?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And then Frank Wilczek, the Nobel laureate physicist, he raises empirical objections. He looks at the universe itself.
What does he see?
He points out that our universe seems to have all this hidden complexity, these weird quantum rules, strict local laws of physics that don't change over time or space.
Yeah.
And he asks, why would a simulator bother with all that? It seems unnecessary and extraneous, like writing tons of extra complex code for background details no player character will ever interact with. It feels wasteful, inefficient for a simulation.
That's a good point. Unnecessary beauty, almost.
Kind of. And he also asks the embarrassing question. If we're in a simulation, what's the computer running it made of? What are the physical laws of that reality?
The infinite regress problem. Turtles all the way down.
Pretty much. Simulations within simulations within simulations. Yeah. Where does it stop? Brian Eggleston also pointed out a logical loop. The future humans of our specific universe can't logically be the ones running the simulation of our specific universe if the argument relies on them being descendants within it.
Okay, my head hurts slightly now.
Huh. Yeah, it gets naughty. And finally, there are motivational objections. Physicist Marcelo Gleiser just questions the why.
Why bother?
Right. Why would super advanced post-humans spend potentially vast resources simulating an entire universe, especially one filled with, let's be honest, a lot of suffering and mundane stuff? He calls it a colossal waste of time.
Maybe they're historians or scientists.
Maybe. But Gleiser argues it seems inefficient and again raises that first cause problem. If they're so advanced, wouldn't they have better, more interesting things to do than rerun history?
This leads to a really fascinating, almost spooky ethical thought from Preston Green.
Ah, yes. The idea that maybe we shouldn't dig too deep.
Right. That finding out we are in a simulation might actually end the simulation. Mm-hmm. Like, if we become self-aware in the wrong way, the simulators just pull the plug.
It's a chilling thought. Which then connects to Robin Hanson, the economist, and his rather strange advice.
What's that?
He suggested that if you suspect you're simulated, maybe you should strive to be entertaining and praiseworthy.
To keep the simulators interested, so they don't shut you down or delete your file.
Basically, yeah. Or, on the flip side, he notes that realizing you might be in a simulation could really mute your motivation for long-term planning.
Mm.
Why save for retirement if it's all just code that could be wiped tomorrow?
Wow. Yeah, that would definitely change your perspective on, well, everything. Daily life, goals.
Absolutely.
Okay, let's shift gears a bit. Moving away from the purely philosophical or the criticisms, how does this simulation idea connect with, say, actual science, like computation theories?
Yeah, it ties in very closely with computationalism. That's the theory that at its core, cognition thinking, consciousness is a form of computation.
So the brain is like biological hardware running consciousness software.
In a nutshell, yes. Yeah. And if that's true, and if artificial consciousness is possible, meaning consciousness doesn't need squishy brain stuff, it just needs the right computational structure, then creating simulated minds, simulated conscious subjects, becomes theoretically possible. It implies consciousness could be platform independent. Run it on silicon, run it on neurons, maybe run it on something else entirely.
Like Hans Moravec explored with mathematical realism, the idea that computation itself could instantiate consciousness.
Exactly. If the patterns and relationships are complex enough, maybe the substrate doesn't matter.
Okay, so what about physics? How do physicists grapple with a potentially computational universe?
Well, physicist John Archibald Wheeler had this famous phrase, it from bit, suggesting information is fundamental. That led to sort of two main views in physics related to this.
Okay.
One is that the universe literally is a quantum computer, that the laws of physics are the algorithm it's running.
The universe as the simulation and the computer running it.
Kind of, yeah. The other view is that our simulated universe is distinct from the underlying reality. The computer running it exists in a different substrate or dimension.
But not all physicists buy the universe as a quantum computer idea.
No, definitely not. Dave Bacon, a quantum computing expert, has been quite critical. He points out there's not much solid evidence for the universe being fundamentally digital or discrete at the lowest level, the Planck scale. And more importantly, he argues that the advocates of this view haven't really produced unique testable predictions that have been confirmed by experiment. It remains largely speculative.
Which brings us to testing. Have scientists actually proposed concrete experiments to try and detect if we're in a simulation? That feels like the crucial next step.
They have, which is really fascinating. Back in 2012, there was a notable paper by Silas Bean, Zora Davoodi, and Martin Savage.
Okay, what did they propose?
They argued that if the simulation has finite computational resources, which seems likely, you can't have infinite computing power, then space-time itself might not be perfectly smooth and continuous. It might have to be broken down into discrete points, like a grid.
Like pixels on a screen, but for reality.
Exactly. And they suggested this underlying grid, this lattice structure, could potentially lead to observable effects.
Such as?
One key prediction was a potential anisotropy in the distribution of ultra-high-energy cosmic rays.
Okay, break that down.
Basically, cosmic rays are super-energetic particles hitting Earth from space.
Hmm.
Normally, you'd expect them to come pretty much uniformly from all directions.
Right. Space is big.
But if space has an underlying grid structure, maybe these highest energy particles would interact with that grid in a way that makes them slightly more likely to arrive from certain directions aligned with the grid axis rather than others.
So we'd see a preferred direction, a pattern that shouldn't be there.
Precisely. Finding such an anisotropy, a directional preference, could be a potential signature of a simulated reality. There were also other experimental proposals, like one by Campbell and colleagues in 2017.
Wow. So people are actually looking for the seams in reality.
They're proposing ways to look, yeah.
Yeah.
It's incredibly difficult. These effects would likely be tiny, but the fact that physicists are thinking about how to test it empirically takes it beyond pure philosophy.
So how has this whole idea landed with the general public?
Yeah.
And with, you know, big names in science or tech?
It's had a really interesting reception. Take Neil deGrasse Tyson, the astrophysicist.
Yep.
He famously said he thought the odds were better than 50-50. They were in a simulation. He even said, I wish I could summon a strong argument against it, but I can find none, which is a pretty strong statement.
Definitely. Did he stick with that?
Well, later, apparently, his friend, the physicist J. Richard Gott, raised an objection based on us being typical observers. The idea that if simulations are common, we likely wouldn't be the first non-simulated reality, or maybe we'd be late in a chain of simulations. This apparently made Tyson reconsider, remarking something like, that changes my life.
Huh. Interesting. What about someone like Elon Musk? He seems interested in this stuff.
Oh, very much so. Musk has repeatedly said he thinks the argument for simulation is quite strong and that it's most likely we're in a simulation.
Wow, most likely.
Yeah, he's even put odds on it, like a 1 in billions chance we're in base reality.
Mm.
His reasoning often comes back to video games. He argues, look how far games has come in just a few decades. Extrapolate that out, and eventually, games will be totally indistinguishable from reality.
Mm.
And if that's possible, odds are someone, somewhere, has already done it, and we're in one.
It's a compelling line of thought, the speed of technological progress.
It is. It definitely makes you wonder.
Okay, so we've gone from the huge scale of the universe down to physics experiments. Let's bring it even closer to home. What about something like a dream? How does that relate?
The dream argument is really a classic form of simulation hypothesis, isn't it? When you're dreaming, you're experiencing a fabricated reality that feels completely convincing at the time.
Right. You're fooled.
Exactly. Bertrand Russell acknowledged that logically we can't prove we aren't always dreaming, though he argued common sense suggests we probably aren't. And Zhuangzi's butterfly dream is the perfect ancient example of using a dream to question reality.
And Descartes, wasn't he famous for questioning dreams too?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
In his Meditations, he has that famous line, there are no certain indications by which we may clearly distinguish wakefulness from sleep. How do you know you're not dreaming right now?
It's a question that really sticks with you.
It does. David Chalmers, a philosopher who works a lot on consciousness, actually distinguishes two types. The idea you might be dreaming right now, or the more radical idea that you might always be dreaming, that external reality might not exist at all.
Mm.
Though Wittgenstein had a different take. He thought these kinds of deep skeptical hypotheses were ultimately uncynic nonsensical.
Why nonsensical?
Because, he argued, the very act of forming the hypothesis, of using language and concepts to doubt reality, relies on a shared, stable reality and knowledge that the hypothesis itself is trying to undermine. You're sawing off the branch you're sitting on, in a way.
Okay, that's a clever counterargument, a foundational challenge.
It is.
So it's clear this idea has deep roots, it challenges us philosophically, it even touches on physics. But let's talk pop culture, because this concept is just everywhere now, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely everywhere. It's really captured the imagination. You can trace it back in literature quite a ways. Daniel F. Galuzzi's novel Simulacron 3 from 1964.
What was that about?
It featured a virtual city, and the inhabitants were conscious computer programs who had no idea they weren't real. Sound familiar?
Very, like an early Matrix.
Exactly. And it was adapted into films, too, like World on a Wire in 73 and The 13th Floor in 99. And you can't forget Philip K. Dick. His story, We Can Remember It For You, Wholesale.
Became Total Recall, right? Playing with implanted memories, fake reality.
Mm-hmm. But the absolute game changer, the one that put simulation theory firmly on the map for millions, was The Matrix in 1999.
Yeah, impossible to overstate its impact. Humanity unknowingly trapped in a simulation by machines.
It became the quintessential reference point. More recently, there was even a play called World of Wires in 2012, partly inspired by Bostrom's actual essay.
And video games must love this theme.
Oh, definitely. You see it in games like Danganronpa 2, which has the Neo World program, a simulation for rehabilitation. Or Anonymous Code, which gets really meta with infinite world layers of simulations and even simulated computer bugs like the year 2038 problem.
Uh-huh. That's great.
TV shows play with it too. Rick and Morty had that hilarious episode, M. Night Shyamalan's, where they're trapped in increasingly bad, low-res simulation.
Right, revealed by the glitches.
And Doctor Who had an episode, Extremis, where the characters realize they're in a simulation because they find a document listing the same random numbers over and over again, a failure of randomization.
It seems like a really fruitful ground for storytelling.
It really is. There have been documentaries, too, like Kent Forbes' The Simulation Hypothesis, featuring Tyson and others. And you hear personal anecdotes like Rizwan Virk, who wrote a book on it, talking about how powerful VR experiences made him genuinely question the nature of base reality.
And wasn't there a recent big streaming series that used it?
Yes. The Netflix series, 1899, from 2022, it built this whole mystery around the characters being trapped in a simulation with memory wipes involved, which kind of echoes that Preston Green idea about the danger of knowing too much.
It really feels like the more our own technology advances, especially with VR and AI, the less far-fetched this whole idea seems to people.
I think that's exactly right. It resonates more and more.
Wow. Okay, what a journey we've been on from ancient Chinese philosophers dreaming of butterflies all the way to cutting-edge physics looking for cosmic ray patterns and, you know, blockbuster movies about digital realities. The simulation hypothesis truly spans this incredible range of human thought.
It really does. Yeah. And look, we still don't have a definitive yes or no answer. Probably won't anytime soon, maybe never.
Right.
But the power of the idea, I think, is that it forces you to interrogate your own assumptions. The assumptions about reality, what consciousness is, the very structure of existence. It just makes you look at everything a little differently.
It certainly does. So the final thought to leave everyone with: if, just if, our reality is some kind of simulation, what does that mean for us? For purpose, for meaning, for how we even pursue knowledge? How might just entertaining that thought, even for a moment, change how you experience the rest of your day?